Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host, and our guest today is Admiral Paul Zeekompt, 25th Commandant of the U.S. Coast Guard. Also joining our conversation from IBM is Don Fenhagen. Admiral, given the age and condition of the U.S. Coast Guard's legacy assets, future mission success relies on completing the planned recapitalization of Coast Guard boats, cutters, aircraft, systems, and infrastructure. Would you discuss the importance of asset recapitalization and capacity building for the U.S. Coast Guard? What challenges are you facing in this area?
Yeah. First, our surprise was the 16 budget. The 17, the jury is still out on that one. We're doing the marks on it. We had built out our program of record of 8 national security cutters. And quite honestly, when I was stationed in D.C. in 2010, we weren't certain if we were going to get a 5th or even a 6th national security cutter. This our 16 appropriation awarded a 9th national security cutter. So we went from 8 to 9. We're building out very capable patrol boats. We call these fast response cutters, commanded by a lieutenant. It's the best lieutenant job in any military service. These are awesome platforms. And so we have the appropriation. We'll build out 58 of these. What will really define the Coast Guard going forward in the maritime realm is going to be the offshore patrol cutter. We have 3 contractors vying for that final bid, and we will down-select it probably in the August timeframe of this year, which will launch the largest acquisition in Coast Guard history. The program of record for that would build out 25 offshore patrol cutters at a point in time where our 210-foot medium endurance cutters are approaching their 50th year of service. Mm-hmm. And by the time that first offshore patrol cutter is delivered, some of those ships will actually be approaching 55 years of service. Will they serve for that long? Clearly, if they're not safe to sail, we may have to take them out of commission. And then finally, the real big piece in all of this is the recapitalization of our icebreaker fleet. Our 17 budget does have a $150 million set aside to at least get into the design work. And we've already reached out to industry, and they are keenly interested in building heavy icebreakers here in the United States, which we have not done in over 40 years.
Mm-hmm. Are you doing anything to accelerate the acquisition?
For the icebreakers, we are. We've already completed the requirements document, which normally would, that process, believe it or not, takes a year and a half to 2 years because there's at least 7 other agencies within the federal government that have equity in the Arctic: Interior, Defense, National Science Foundation, Arctic Research Council, and the list goes on to include Coast Guard. So we're going to build an icebreaker. You want to make sure if you're building this more than a minivan, that it has all the features in it that will appeal to the needs of all those who have Arctic equity. So we've done that, and that's already cleared. We're reaching out to several countries that have designs on the table for heavy icebreakers. And if we can accelerate the design work for that by taking a parent craft design, that will buy us several years as well. So a lot of that outreach has already been done. We held an industry day about 6 weeks ago. We had nearly 300 people show up, including from the international community, knowing that there's $150 million in the 17 budget request. When we had $3 million in that account and we reached out to industry, we literally had 3 people that expressed any interest just to see if we were serious enough, mm-hmm. serious or not. And at that point, they said, well, you're not serious. There's not real money here. Mm-hmm. So there's clearly an appetite. And this is important within our industrial base as well, that we have the ability to demonstrate that we can produce this type of a ship, which we have not produced in over 40 years.
So we know the Coast Guard is dedicated to strategically investing and being fiscally accountable while sustaining mission success. You talked earlier about being proud about the clean financial audit. Can you tell us a little bit more about your financial management system improvement initiative?
Yeah, Don, the biggest challenge we have right now is we have a number of ledgers that we have to maintain, and they're all being maintained manually. So if I were to ask my chief financial officer how much money is in the checking account today, he can probably, maybe by the end of July, tell me what's in the checking account. And we want to make sure that we're spending down, that we don't find ourselves in violation of the Deficit Act. And so typically at the end of any fiscal year, we always leave a little bit of a cushion. Now, the good news is it's usually less than 1%. But the fact of the matter is that we do not have centrally total visibility of our ledgers because they're disaggregated. And so we need to pull all of that together using a program of record under what we call our Financial Management System 2, which is a program that has been by the Department of Agriculture, I believe it is, but using a parent design, tailoring it to the needs of the Coast Guard so we can have near real-time visibility of, quite honestly, what's in the checkbook so we can have a repeatable process of how can we assure open book a clean financial audit opinion.
So while technological advancements in maritime shipping and industries have improved safety, vulnerabilities in the cyber domain are creating new risks. Would you tell us more about these new cyber threats? More importantly, what are you doing to address the cyber risks? Perhaps you can highlight some of the key strategies that compose your cyber risk strategy.
We rolled out our cyber strategy about a year and a half ago. And the first pillar on that is defending our cyber networks. And so after the OPM compromise, we stood up a crisis action team of over 80 people. Now, the first challenge is, who are your cyber experts within your enterprise? Because we have not created a program of record. But we have more than 80 people that know what cyber is. They work in our information technology world. But we brought them in and then try to penetrate all of the applications that we have as a potential adversary to find out what vulnerabilities we had in the Coast Guard. And we found a number of them. And so we've corrected those. Some of it is antiquated operating systems. So it's going to take real money to correct those as well. So that was one element of cyber, is being able to protect what you have. The other is, how do you use cyber offensively? You can think in terms of search and rescue. We use cyber to take the search out of rescue. Actually, it's as simple as someone has a distress beacon, they're in the middle of the Atlantic or Pacific, and we know where they're at. It goes to a satellite, it comes down, but that's all cyber-enabled. But we also use cyber to go after counter-drug activity. The reason we doubled down in the drug transit zones was, a little over 2 years ago, we actually had at least one source of intelligence. Some of it might have been through the cyber domain, might have been human intelligence, but where about 85% of the flow was on any given day out in the ocean. But we can only target maybe at best 15% of that 85%, which means 70% are getting a free pass. Mm-hmm. So it was probably back in November, we had six go-fast loaded with drugs over an expanse of the equivalent of North and Central America. Six boats, each about 30 feet in length, and we were able to put an airplane on top of, and then an armed helicopter on top of, and then a ship next to all six of those, and we were able to get all six of these. The other is, as we look at our regulatory authorities, how do we protect our maritime transportation system from cyber intrusions as well? One of the biggest vulnerabilities are internal, what we call a violation of cyber hygiene. We've had several mobile offshore drilling units in the last several years that drove off the site that they were drilling in deep water. Malware had gotten into their main control console. We don't know how it got there, but it caused that main control console to lose communication with the thrusters, and so it literally drove off the well site. Fortunately, the blowout preventer kicked in, and we didn't have another deep water horizon. It cost the industry millions of dollars. As you look at lease rates for a mobile offshore drilling unit, you've got to go back and reestablish that well site. Time is money. So industry is very incentivized right now on how do they harden their cyber defenses as well. But looking to the Coast Guard, looking to the National Institute of Standards and Technology of what are the best practices for cyber. And just because you might have the best practices today, this is going to be an ever-evolving threat, so it may change one day to the next as well. But we're doing a lot of outreach right now with the maritime industry on cyber awareness and then what standards might they implement to harden their defenses.
So, Admiral, when I was preparing for this interview, I read your State of the Coast Guard address, and I really appreciated the line you had about hearkening back to the lessons of the Royal Navy. You can't surge experience and leadership. You have to grow it from bottom up. So to that end, could you elaborate on your human capital strategy, and more particularly, what are you doing to retain and attract a leadership pipeline for the future?
Right now, our retention rates are the highest among any of the armed services. Now, part of that, we place a premium on our mid to senior enlisted pay grades. I don't need a brigade of privates. I need more experienced petty officers in the Coast Guard. But this comes at a point in time where we have the best educated enlisted workforce in Coast Guard history. I sponsored a company at Cape May where our recruits go through basic training. And out of that company of 90, 40 of them had bachelor's degrees. And out of that 40 with bachelor's degrees, 18 of them had master's degrees to be an E2 in the United States Coast Guard. So you've got this best educated workforce. You've got a baby boomer generation as myself getting ready to time out. The average age of our civilian workforce is 51 years old. Where are you going to find that talent? At a point in time where maybe 25% of the youth between 17 and 24 meet the bare minimum requirements to serve in the United States military. And I'm not going for that 20 to 25% I'm going for the upper tier. So there could be recruiting challenges. There could be enticements by the high-tech sector, airline industry, maritime industry to draw talent away from the Coast Guard. And the talent that they'll draw from will be at that middle tier of the Coast Guard, the most critical part of the Coast Guard. Throw on top of that blended retirement, which will kick in 2018, that won't provide the same incentives as we have under our current retirement policy for folks that at least serve 20 years. Because I really need that 12 to 16 year mark. But quite honestly, today, if someone has 12 years of service in the Coast Guard, they're going to do 20. I don't have that insurance. So it's the unknown of what's out there. So we need to make sure that we're in front of that. So a big part of that is, what is it that incentivizes people to stay in the Coast Guard? We'll actually start looking at instruments, tools to try to assess somebody's commitment. I know that the IT industry uses that right now to gauge whether someone is just looking for the next highest bidder and they don't have that full commitment to that particular organization, because I cannot get in a bidding war, can't pay those type of incentives. But it's important that, and right now we have people that are directly connected to the mission, regardless of what they do in the organization. It's like the NASA model.
Yes.
When you told the janitor, what do you do? I am putting a man on the moon.
Right.
And you could ask anyone in the Coast Guard, indirectly or directly, I'm going to save a life. I'm going to improve our economy. I'm going to keep drugs off the street, you name it. So we need to make sure that we always have that connective tissue to what we do, and we do it with our workforce as well. But if we turn a blind eye to this, we can find ourselves with a hole in the organization where you can't surge experience, and you certainly can't surge leadership.
So you talk about the managing talent in the 21st century and the new skills that are going to be required. So obviously, the complexity and diversity of the Coast Guard's mission sets require a range of analytical techniques and approaches to manage them effectively. This is one of the new needs that you're going to have in this new workforce. What are you all doing to increase the use of analytics and enhancing the analytical capabilities of your organization right now?
We're looking at right now. We look at education experience that people have, but we've always we've put that on the shoulders of our assignment officers, and all they're looking for is a body to fill a billet. And maybe it's not the ideal fit. And so we've gone different ways. We've looked at needs of the member, needs of the service, but through our analytics. So if we've made the training investment, it works pretty straightforward in our aviation community. If we send you off and you become an aircraft commander, well, we're not going to send you off now and learn how to drive a ship. You are going to work in the aviation industry. Within our marine inspection program, though, we've had a lot of leaks in that program. We'll send folks to a lot of training, and then right when you want to get a return on that investment, that individual will say, well, I want to go off and do something completely different in the Coast Guard. They cut a deal with their assignment officer, and even though they might be that round peg in a square hole, we do that, but we bleed down the capability of that program, and we actually we lose some public trust with the maritime industry when they never see us get beyond the journeyman level of an industry that we regulate. And so we need to make sure that we are one step ahead of and not lagging behind the industry that we regulate. It's no different in intelligence. When we first rolled out the National Security Cutter, one of our number one causes of casualties were not mechanical failures, it was human failure, non-familiarity with the systems that we were operating. When you leave one of those ships today, you get preferred assignments, and most people would prefer not to go to sea again. So we're going to have to fix that model as well. And we're already looking at, well, how do we incentivize sea duty, especially on the larger ships, and pay them a larger sea duty premium than we would someone going to a smaller ship. But as you're building more complex systems, as we recapitalize, we need to make sure that we're making the same investments and we're leveraging the talents of our people most effectively. And so that's a big part of the analytics. But it really applies across acquisition, across legal, air, land, and sea, pretty much everything that we do.
And speaking about what you do, Admiral, I'd like to get your perspective about Major emergency responses. You mentioned earlier Deepwater Horizon. You had Katrina, the Haitian earthquake. What lessons, from your perspective, have been learned and applied to other emergency efforts that you've responded to?
I always know that you're dealing with a complex catastrophe when the Kennedy School of Government shows up in the middle of your response because you're the next case study. So I was the federal on-scene coordinator for the Deepwater Horizon oil spill. And right at the height of that, here is Dutch Leonard and Lenny Marcus, the two gurus behind the Kennedy School of Government. You are now a case study. But if you look at, the Deepwater Horizon oil spill, just prior to that, we had the Haiti earthquake. And there was political unrest. You've got a cholera outbreak. And quite honestly, all the seeds germinating for a potential mass migration. Now you have the worst oil spill in U.S. history, compounded by the fact that it's now during hurricane season. So if you can imagine Katrina and the tidal surge, but now the tidal surge has oil on the top of it. And you've got midterm elections taking place. And what if you have a terrorist threat thrown on top of that? And what if the Cascadia subduction zone in the Pacific Northwest decides that that's the day it's going to release? And the reason I mention that, because that's where we pulled a lot of our initial responders from an area that hasn't been impacted to where it is to be able to bolster up our numbers. Well, you may not have that luxury going into the future. We've been fortunate when you had Katrina, when you had Deepwater Horizon. Those were one events. But what if you compound that with another one and we become a Coast Guard that, is out of Schlitz, that can't answer to more than one mission at a time? And so when I gave my State of the Coast Guard address, I alluded to the fact that we're semper paratus for a best case world, a somewhat static world. But when you start throwing in some of these other complexities, it's very hard to say that we are semper paratus for those contingencies because we don't have a force in garrison. And our reserve component today is the smallest it's been since the Korean War. And that is my cavalry, if you will, and they do a great job at it. But we're not a Coast Guard man to the level to meet some of these contingencies.
What does the future hold for the U.S. Coast Guard? We will ask Admiral Paul Ziecoft, Commandant of the U.S. Coast Guard, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour.